gentlemen, boys and girls, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. Welcome to another exciting episode. And some weeks that's actually true. Other weeks, the dismal science of economics is not exciting, no matter how much we wish it were. We do our best, but come on, guys. We're talking about things that are mildly related to actuarial and accounting degrees. This week should be more interesting if anybody's been paying attention. If you're not paying attention, it's because you're so sick of paying attention that you've already thrown up your guts. You're probably not listening at this point either. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure, and on the line with me, I have
Jeff McClure.
And together, we are the not only the hosts of this program, we're also the principals at an SEC-registered investment advisory firm. Now, the two don't bridge very well. We're not giving investment advice on the air here. We're giving educational content on the air. And just because we're registered with our firm with the SEC doesn't mean that they approve of us in any way, shape, or fashion. In fact, asking the government to approve of someone, I don't know, that might have a reverse effect. Approved by the government would probably make me not want to go there.
No, I've got it. I'm approved by the government. I have a passport. It says so right there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I can pass the ports. Yes, I can do that as well.
Oh.
Do you want to take the next disclosure? I covered two at one.
That was good. That was good. And we don't pay for this radio program, nor are we paid to do this radio program. We do advertise on KTEM for the radio program. I'm not sure how that relates, but one doesn't necessarily lead to the other, but that's where we are.
Yeah, and the radio program also pays for advertisement for the radio program, which isn't from us.
So this is weird. That's okay.
Yeah. The information, I'm going to get to say the deem word this time. The information that we provide is from sources. Information is that plural?
It is. Now, if you said data, it would be our.
Data is plural and information is singular. Okay. So the information that we acquire comes from places that we deem to be reliable. Why do we deem that? Because they come from reputable sources. And if you wish sources for what we're talking about, you can request that. If you would like to email us, we will get it to you. And I'm not going to give the warranty guarantee portion of it because I feel like it is utterly redundant. We just said we deem it to be so. Okay, all right, I'll do it. We make no warranty or guarantee that the information that we are giving you is correct. We believe it is. We deem it to be, and we're taking it from sources that most people would deem to be correct, but fake news is real.
You know,
wait a minute. That's an oxymoron.
This is not the way you're supposed to do this. You're supposed to on disclaimers and disclosures like that. You're supposed to say them really, really fast
and monotone.
The information we are presenting on this program, we deem to be from sources we deem to be reliable, and we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information.
I think we should just say. We can replace all of that with fake news is real, which is literally an oxymoron.
I don't like fake news.
Well, it's real. But if it's real, how is it fake?
I don't know.
It's real fake news. What?
We try to avoid fake news with all our hearts, and we use sources. The primary source we use is the Wall Street Journal, though we use other sources like Morningstar and Financial Times.
The Economist. Yeah, let me look up here and see what we've got. Financial Times, I've got The Economist, I've got Wall Street Journal, Labor Department, CNN Business, we have to be careful there. They start to lean. Got to watch those leans. Wall Street Journal opinion leans in the other direction from CNN, so you have to watch those leanings too. But that's neither here nor there. It's actually somewhere else besides here and there, probably beside itself, whatever it's doing. But we want to talk about what's happened this week in the market. It's been an interesting week.
The market, the stock market, represented by the S&P 500 stock index, which is probably the best, if thoroughly imperfect, way of measuring what the market's doing. Rose very nicely this week. It ended the week up 3.84%, which is pretty amazing. Closed out at 3477.13. It's up almost 8% year-to-date, but about 3% below its high at the beginning of September. In other words, we're still in a dip following September. We had a nice run-up this week. Of course, in the middle of the week, I say in the middle of the week, late Tuesday, when the president tweeted that he was calling off all talks on the stimulus until after the election, the market took a serious dip at the end of the day.
Yeah, that was one, if you don't mind me jumping in there. All you have to do is look at the day in the market, the graph for the market that day. And it's got kind of, all right, it's kind of heading up a little bit. It's not got a lot of volatility. And then there's a steep cliff. Boom. And it is timed within seconds of the tweet from the president saying stimulus is off until after the election.
Well, I've read from several reliable sources that the president is very sensitive to movements in the market.
Yes.
And as a result, the next day, he suddenly became very favorable for a stimulus bill of some kind. And by the end of the week, he was saying he wanted to, he said this on the Rush Limbaugh show, that he was, that he wanted a stimulus bigger than the Democrats wanted. And the market, as a result, soared during the week, almost 4%. And therein, I mean, his words move things, and they move things for a very simple reason. The same week, Chairman Powell, the Federal Reserve, said there would probably be tragic consequences if we didn't get a major stimulus bill. And by a major,
he said that on Monday. Yeah, on Monday he said that. Tuesday, the president says no. Wednesday, he says yes.
The point in this is the market is moved very profoundly, and this week showed it very, very directly that this next stimulus bill is critical, and we're going to talk about that. There's indications that we're sliding back into recession right now. And we're, for instance, consumer credit has been expanding for the last 2 months after shrinking. I mean, in June and July, and it expanded in May and April and March, of course, it contracted.
Consumer credit is credit cards. It's also personal loans.
Mm-hmm.
So during the time of the stimulus, we were seeing people pay down their debts with an expectation of maybe needing to get more debt later if the stimulus ended. Well, the stimulus ended, and amazingly, they got more debt. So go ahead.
But what happened was people were spending more money in June and July, going along very nicely. We're just now getting the figures for August. In August, the amount of money that people were spending shrunk. Consumers were spending on their credit cards, for example, shrunk by 7.2%, which is a pretty big move historically. And normally, when people stop spending money, you don't see the effect in the economy because of the lag and the numbers that come out of the Commerce Department. But you don't see the real effect of this for several months. But in August, when the stimulus payments for unemployment ended, we're now seeing the results. Revolving credit was down 9.4%. That's things like credit cards. So people stopped buying things. And so that's not good. And it's not good because if people stop buying things, people stop spending money, or people slow their spending down, that's what causes a recession. And that's what we're seeing happening. And it's crucial. And I think the chairman of the Federal Reserve saw this before it was released. He normally does. And it's crucial that we get money back in people's pockets or we slide into recession. And if we slide into recession, more businesses will fail. More people will be laid off. And I'll make a prediction right now. In the next few weeks, we're going to see a jump in the number of people filing for unemployment, probably a very significant jump.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But do you want to cover what happened in the market beyond the collapse? I mean, it's got good news at the end of it.
Well, I told you it was up 3.84% this week, and that's really amazing. It's up almost 8% year to date. 10-year Treasury note yield, which is a good way of forecasting what the bond market thinks the future is going to be, it jumped 11.8% to yield 0.78. Now, 0.78 for a 10-year Treasury, that's peanuts. That's truly peanuts compared with what we've seen in the past. But and this treasury yield curve steepened, which says things will be better. But for instance, the yield on the 10-year treasury, which is an indication of future borrowing, it's an indication of borrowing demand in the open market, is down 60% from where it was at the beginning of the year, which indicates the signal is we're going to have a recovery based on the present information. Within the next year, we'll see a good recovery, but the recovery will be a multi-year process and it will be muted. Oil also jumped up above $40 to $40.55 West Texas Intermediate. Again, that's an indicator because it's a price based on supply and demand. It indicates that people believe, because these are futures contracts that oil is priced on, people believe that the demand for oil will grow next year. And people believe the demand for borrowed money will grow next year. Now, it's all very good, and we see a lot of these indicators that things are slowly recovering, and they're good positive indicators. But it's important to remember, it's kind of like a swimming pool. Jake likes to use a swimming pool analogy for the economy. It's kind of like if you drained a swimming pool by 50%, and then you had a pool of water and it had 1,000 gallons in it, and you drained it down to 500 gallons, and then you added 300 gallons. That 300 gallon add would be a really big punch, really big growth. You'd have a 30% growth. Everybody'd be celebrating, but you're still 200 gallons below before you were when you started, and that's what's going on in the economy right now.
Exactly. And it's not a 30% growth from that 500.
No, that'd be a 60% growth.
Yeah, so you get a 60% growth, but it doesn't make up for the 50% loss. And that's weird. I know people, it's not intuitive to think like that, but if you're at 1,000, you drop to 500, and then you boost it by 300, you're still well below what you were. And what that means is that we're still in recovery. And this is one of those things that headlines, particularly in a political era, and I've seen this on both sides of the spectrum trying to meet different points, make it look like we're either having great growth or horrible growth. The reality is that we're having a very quick recovery from a massive downturn, but that quick recovery suddenly stalled. And one of the other pieces of this labor stuff that's happened, and I think it's important to bring this up, about 700,000 people left the workforce in September. What does that mean? They stopped looking for work. They fell off. Why did they stop working for work? They wish they could have work. But the way the statistics work is that if you've been out of the workforce long enough, you don't get unemployment unless you're going out and actively interviewing or virtually interviewing for jobs. Well, of those almost 700,000, 617,000 of them were women. Just think about that for a second. Six out of, well, it's like totality of about, it's almost 800 or 700,000 people, and 617,000 of them were women that fell out of the workforce. Why? Well, there's a couple of reasons. The small reasons I'll hit first. The very small reasons are hospitality is the one of the largest hit areas, both in dining and in hotel use. And that's an area with a great number of female employees. But that's a small reason for this. This isn't the big reason. That's just a little thing. The big thing is that we still culturally see that women should be the ones that stay home with their kids. Now, whether or not that's correct is irrelevant. It's really not. Culturally, what we're seeing right now, why 617,000 women left the workforce, is because the cultural significance of who stays home with the kids. Because people are worried about sending their kids to school or to daycare. That's the big reason why people are not able to get back to working. One of them. So even though if you go out and put an ad out for a job right now, you're going to get inundated with people looking for jobs. But there will be less women in that group than there used to be. a lot less. So that's just an important factor in here to know that this, it's evolving. The way we're seeing what this recovery is evolving, and we kind of expected this to occur. It's happening the way we expected it to, because there's really no other way for it to happen. But each of these points is a milestone that needs to be pointed out. These women would really like to go back to work. Go ahead.
I listened to Jamie Dimon talk about this subject. He's trying to get people back into his into the culture, physically back to work.
Yeah. Jamie Dimon is the CEO of JP Morgan Chase.
And he's concerned that they're losing their combined culture because they're not interacting at work. So he set up a program to safely distance the desk spaces and put barriers between them and change the ventilation in the offices so that they'd be safe. And he started trying to bring people back to work, and he realized in many cases only the men were coming back. So he was inadvertently creating a male-only culture in his company.
By trying to keep establishment of the existing culture before the pandemic. Yeah.
80% of the women that he invited back said, we can't come back because we're taking care of kids. We're homeschooling at the same time we're working from home. So he basically abandoned the attempt to get everybody back in there. And he said, very disappointed about that. He said, but that's just the reality. Daycare and schools are closed, and daycare is scary.
And even if they're open, they close quickly and then open back up and then close quickly and then open back up. If they have one case at the school, if it's a small daycare, they have to shut the place down, and they have to shut it down for 10 days. If they don't, then they're in violation of almost every state's health department standards for daycares. The licensing stuff is real. I mean, this is stuff that's been on the books for licensing of daycare facilities for decades. It's not new stuff, but they're applying the pandemic code to the letter of the licensing regulations.
And there's some evidence that we've talked about this before and we've written about it before. The typical pandemic comes in three waves. The 1918 flu came in three waves. We've had the first wave, and we're now back down towards the bottom of the trough and the wave. And everybody thinks, in the generally speaking, what I read is people think, okay, it's pretty much over. We pretty much got it under control. But now we're actually seeing a rise in new cases in the United States. We're seeing in Europe is definitely hitting the second wave. They're having a surge of new cases across Europe. These do come in waves. And the waves probably have a lot to do with human behavior and the issue.
Well, let me throw this in here. It isn't probably. They absolutely do. And this is one of those things that we're learning about this, about pandemics in general, is that the COVID virus, vid is the viral, so virus disease, the COVID-19 isn't seasonal. It isn't like the cold or the flu, where it spreads only in the winter months, and in the summer it's really rare to get it. It's not seasonal, which means if you just looked at the virus, you don't get waves of this. It's going to be around. But if you look at human interaction, this is where the waves are coming from. As we lighten up controls, we get a resurgence. And this is what we're seeing in France and in Germany and in the United States right now. You're seeing this resurgence because certain states are loosening standards at the same time that other states are tightening standards. And that means that we have more human interaction, and thus this, the air quotes around, it's really a wave of human behavior rather than a wave of some kind of change in the way the virus acts.
The only real historical model we have to work with is the 1918 flu. It came in three waves, and it's been studied and studied and studied. The 1918 pandemic, sometimes called the Spanish flu, although it apparently originated in Kansas, so we should probably call it Spanish, because there's a lot of Spaniards in Kansas, I think, or something.
There could be. Yeah, there could be.
Anyway, that one came in three waves. The first wave was bad. People reacted to it. People took proper precautions, and they got it down to a low level, but it was still there. Then they loosened up their safety precautions. They started behaving normally again and gathering again. We got the second wave, and again, they reacted, not as strongly, but they reacted and separated themselves. You know, when bodies are piling up in the streets, people tend to react to things. And then they were loosened up again, and by this time, they had what is now being referred to as precautionary fatigue. They just simply were tired of distancing themselves. They were tired of not getting together in groups. So they really gave it up when it dipped after the second time. And the third time, amazingly, was the most deadly. It was the worst part of the flu. It was in 1921, I think it was.
Yeah, and that's strict. I mean, very, very much so. At the time, there's headlines about people getting tired of having to wear masks. And so they just stopped wearing masks. Because at that point, tracking was not a known technology. It was totally written down with a pencil on a piece of paper. So you couldn't see any benefit from wearing a mask.
The tracking was used for animals.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
People are still tracking animals in the wild. When they say trains and animals are over-tracked. But this is the point. Hopefully we'll have a vaccine in place to prevent the third wave. The key right now to holding this flu epidemic from creating a second major wave is our behavior. If we can wear our masks, if we can keep ourselves distanced from each other, we cannot gather together in closed buildings and big rooms. I know this sounds really strange and it's not very nice for the people who run restaurants, but a lot of the new surge that's going on right now is coming from people going to restaurants. Pretty clearly, people go to restaurants and days later they have the coronavirus. People in restaurants obviously are not wearing masks. I tried eating with a mask on. It doesn't work real well.
It's really chewy.
Yeah. And people talk when they're in restaurants, and if there's music in the background in a restaurant, sometimes it's loud, and people have to talk loudly, which means they're expelling a lot. If they're contagious at that point, even if they have no symptoms, they're going to be spreading a lot of viruses through the air, and the people around them are likely to get them. I say around, meaning within about 50 feet.
Right. That, and we're probably going to wind up speaking more about the virus this hour and next hour. It's because it's unavoidable when you're talking about the economy at this point. It's just impossible to say, to talk about labor statistics or economic growth without factoring in the virus. So expect us to talk more about it. But there's a lot of other stuff that's been going on. Six additional chicken industry officials have been indicted on price fixing. This is on top of the two that were already indicted. Have you been following this?
I have.
It's quite fascinating.
Chicken
price fixing. Yes. The major chicken producers, it's not really the producers, because there's a bunch of co-ops that grow chickens. And then they sell them at big auction markets to the people like Pilgrim's Pride and all the places that you would look at in the frozen food department and see chickens for sale. They go to those big auctions and they hold those auctions throughout the day, every day. And it came to light a couple of years ago. The investigation really got rolling in 2017, that executives from competing companies were texting each other during the auctions about what they were going to bid on and what the other shouldn't bid on so that they could get the bids, and what they wouldn't bid on so that the other would. That's the essence. That is the absolute definition of price fixing, where the big industry executives, this isn't a dark smoke-filled room. This was text messages to each other on the floors of the auctions, where they were saying, I'm not going to bid on this one, you get it, and vice versa. And it was consistent and over a great long period of time. So who does this hurt and who does this help? Who it hurts is the people that grow the chickens. they don't get paid a good competitive price for their chickens. Who does it help? It helps these middle from the market to the grocery store big companies.
So we're talking about Pilgrim's Pride and Tyson here, probably.
Yeah, those are the two big ones, but there's a lot of others that were mildly implicated. Those two are the biggest out there. Tyson and Pilgrim's Pride are the two that have had a great deal of executives indicted in this. And what it comes down to is that the grocery stores didn't get a better price on the chicken. That means that the customer also didn't get a better price on the chicken. But if you owned Pilgrim's Pride stock or Tyson stock, you made a profit.
Well, temporarily.
Temporarily. And this is the deal, is that that profit's probably all going to come back out in fees, in fines. And there will be some people that go to jail over this, because it is explicitly illegal to fix prices in a competitive market. You can't do it. It's like two guys at the poker table that are sharing each other's cards. You can't do that. That's not fair. And there's a law against it.
I have some personal experience in the chicken raising market. Up in Oklahoma, where I come from, there's chicken houses everywhere, long chicken houses. What happens is there's a set of companies, the company that they're going to, somebody hatches a lot of chickens. Mm-hmm. They're delivered as chicks. And then it's up to these many, many, many people who used to be regular farmers in the Midwest to raise those chickens, to feed them, to get them ready to go to market, have them in pristine condition. And then they sell their chickens on the market, just like cattle or anything else. They'll sell them on the market, which is theoretically an open bid between the people who are buying chickens to produce them to put them in the grocery store.
Right.
And the problem with this is, when the demand for food went up, and it did, the demand for chicken went up dramatically. The price for chickens, as people were raising them, didn't, but the price of the feed went up, price of everything else went up. Their ability to keep their workers went down. They were struggling, but the price that they got when they brought a chicken to market to be bid for actually dropped during that period of time. And that set off alarms all over the place. The investigation was already going on, but that set off a big alarms when there's a supply and demand constraint and price should go up at the bids, and it didn't. It went down. That is an indication that somebody's cheating, and that's what kicked this into gear and set off the indictments.
Right. So what was going on there is essentially what happens at other levels where it's legal, like in colleges and in hospitals. They're not only allowed to price fix, it's kind of encouraged by the government, but most consumer stuff that's not health or education, price fixing is not legal. It's monopolistic. It's an antitrust concept, and it doesn't help anyone but the shareholders of those corporations that are making the profit here, except I've got to use it. I have to say it. The chickens will come home to roost.
You had to.
I had to. I couldn't avoid. I mean, it was perfect. Chicken thing. See what I did with the chickens. And
nobody here but us chickens.
Yeah. So the fines on Pilgrim's Pride and Tyson are likely to be large and eye-watering. They might chicken out and pay it out.
I suspect there's enough evidence that they've made chicken out on this, yes.
Yeah.
And then, but on the other hand, they could play a game of chicken with the government.
Yeah, I think they've already done that. But the thing is, when you play a game of chicken with the government, generally not a good idea. You generally lose. You get to be that smear on the asphalt because it's a lot bigger than you are.
Speaking of markets, the job market is in a little bit of trouble too. And it's hard to keep up with this because the data comes out weekly and it gets kind of turns into background noise after a while. But we had 840,000 new applications for unemployment last week. Not this week we're in, but the week previous. And that is more than four times the tradition, the normal, in a normal economy, we have around 200,000 a week. We had 840,000. Now, that's lower than the millions we had months ago, but the problem is it's stuck between 800,000 and 900,000. And at the same time, major corporations, the airlines, Disney, and a lot of others have announced that they're going to be doing layoffs next week or the week after. And these layoffs will amount to over 100,000 that they're going to add. So we expect to see that number go up pretty dramatically. That's bad news. That means the recovery has stalled out. Yeah, we're creating new jobs every week and every month, but we're only creating new jobs at about the same rate as we're losing jobs.
Well, yeah, except that exactly. So we're seeing new applications for unemployment. That means that the people that have been waiting to lay off people are finally at the point where they can't hold on anymore. And once that happens, the same people that waited and waited and waited to lay people off are the same people that make the decision to hire people back. And this is part of the reason why employment is considered a lagging indicator. They wait till they have a lot of money on hand before hiring back, because nobody likes to lay people off. They really, really don't. I mean, if you're trying to run a successful business, you can't do that without good employees. And if last week you laid a bunch of them off and this week you get a little bit of extra money, you're very unlikely to turn around and bring them back on, because you don't know how long that new money is going to last. So it delays the recovery. If you require people to lay people off, it delays the recovery because it's going to take longer for them to hire back, if they're around to hire back.
There's two other factors beneath the surface here that are very, very significant and in some cases kind of reverse invisible. One is the number of furloughed people who are out there. There's people who are on unemployment, but they are listed as furloughed, meaning that they expect to go back to work in the same job when this is over, is shrinking because more and more companies are telling their furloughed employees, which weren't listed as unemployed.
Yeah, this is considered a temporary leave. That's the definition of furlough, is a temporary leave, but the temporary has become permanent in a lot of cases.
They're telling these people that you're not going to be able to work. We're not going to hire you back. And the other thing is, as we hit the 6-month point, the number of people that are on continuous unemployment will shrink and is shrinking right now, because at 6 months, the state unemployment runs out. So they're no longer on continuing unemployment. So we're seeing that number come down. But we also have this problem when they hit that point, 6 months or sometimes more, in this case, it's about 6 months after they are unemployed for 6 months, they're looking for work vigorously for 6 months, and then they give up and they drop out of the workforce. So the end result is the next time the unemployment report comes out, it may be lower, but it'd be lower because people are dropping out of the workforce. And people are giving up. And this is what we call permanent damage to the economy. These are people who would like to work, but they've given up looking for work because they can't find any work. And they're tired of looking. And once they run out of unemployment benefits, they just drop out of the workforce.
Right.
There's two major serious damages that are going on to the long-term economy. One, once people drop out of the workforce, they're very reluctant to go back in. And it takes a really strong incentive to get them back into the workforce.
Now, can I address that before you hit second?
Sure.
Just to put some light on that, the percentage of people that dropped out of the workforce during the Great Recession never returned. So we went back up, but we're not back up to the labor force participation rate we were before the Great Recession. This tends to have a lasting damage on the workforce. Okay, back to second.
The second thing is, as these people get laid off, there's a secondary effect that you don't see very well, and that is the businesses that are laying them off are weakened. In many cases, small businesses are shutting down and declaring bankruptcy. Sometimes they're not declaring bankruptcy. They're just closing their doors, stopping paying their rent, and going home. And that doesn't show up on the statistics very well, but very, very real across the country. And as more and more businesses shut down, that'll be fewer and fewer people to hire, fewer and fewer places that people will get hired back. And sure, people will eventually start back, and they'll start back hiring people, making new businesses, but it'll take several years. Members of the Federal Reserve are saying that easily it could be 2023 before we get back into the position of having something near full employment.
Yeah, and I totally agree with that. I think that that is full employment is something that it's hard to get back to when you leave it. I get this question a lot. How come we don't know more about the numbers? How come, you know, these labor numbers come out and we've got different numbers for unemployment from the household survey versus ADP, which is a big payroll provider? And the answer is it's very much like we don't know how many people live in the United States right now. We can estimate, we can say we've got about 320, 330, but this is why we do a census every 10 years, because sometimes people leave, they go and live in another country. Sometimes they have kids over there and come back. They're American citizens. They've got to apply for citizenship, but that database isn't connected with the other databases because we don't really want that. We don't want the government to know all. So when it comes to employment, you don't file documents for statisticians at the labor department when you get a job. A lot of people, they come in and they shake hands and they say, all right, you're hired. Or in this environment, they nod at you through the virtual screen and they say, all right, good to go. But who is notified at some kind of a federal level that's keeping a statistic, very much like trying to track COVID? Who are the hospitals reporting to? And if it's a VA hospital, do they report to the county? Well, no, not in Texas, but in Wisconsin they do. How about military installation hospitals? Who do they report to? Do they report to the county? No. Do they report to the state? No. Do they report to the federal government? Yes. But does the federal government have a central repository for that they're reporting to? No. So it goes back to the state having to contact the counties and individually contacting hospitals. It's a very manpower intensive thing. Lots of phone hours, mostly not by email. We're not good at keeping statistics. We're a lot better than a lot of other countries. So that is kind of the reality of where we stand at the moment. And we're trying to establish our video conference in the background. We're going to go ahead and play some commercials because, Cooper, if you're around, I think it's a good time. If you would like to contact us, we actually have an email waiting that we need to get to. But if you'd like to contact us, we're not taking calls right now, though in the next couple of weeks, we may figure out how to do that because both of us are not at the radio studio right now. If you'd like to contact us, wait a minute here. If you'd like to contact us off the air, email addresses are jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. And we're going to have Cooper, the engineer at the studio, play some commercials for us, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And if they don't start playing the commercials pretty soon, we'll know. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. Again, if you'd like to contact us, we're not taking calls this episode. Hopefully that'll be fixed in the coming weeks. We're learning how to do this virtual thing, huh? Email addresses, if you'd like to join the conversation, are jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. And I think it's a good time to look at the first question. The question is from John. Are college endowment investment choices limited, private versus public colleges? And he's got a picture of the Wall Street Journal coming in with this, and it's got a high return quote on fiscal year return and the median returns for U.S. endowments and so on. The answer on are their choices limited is yes, but not at a federal or state level. They're limited by their own endowment structure. What is a college endowment? Most universities take donations from people. And a lot of times people will leave a university as a beneficiary for a life insurance plan, or in their will, they're going to bequeath a large amount of money, usually to a university that they're connected to through their family somehow. Either they went there, or their kids did, or something like that. It's not often that they leave a bunch of money to a university that they have no connection to. What does the university do with that money? If they've got tuition and they're building their budget around tuition, paying for the facilities and paying for the professors and so on, well, they generally invest it, and that's part of where they get their scholarship money. It's where they get their ability to increase the size of their facilities and make purchases and so on. The Yale endowment was famous all the way coming through the Great Recession for its amazing use of investments to stay stable at a time when the rest of the market was crashing. And then it came out that they were using a form of alternative investment that didn't update its price with the market. So of course it looked like it had a nice stable return during a period of great volatility because the price was still the same as what it was when they bought it, with an incremental increase according to accounting standards rather than according to actual returns on the investment. So hopefully that answered the question. Do you have anything else to add to it?
Well, you said private versus public colleges. Public colleges are a little different in that there's generally, because public colleges like the University of Texas are overseen to some degree by the state because they're funded largely by the state. Their endowment investments have to be reviewed by a board. And the objective there is not to make the highest profit. The objective is balance. It's, for instance, to maintain the level of liquidity. Harvard had to lay off staff this year, and they laid off staff last year despite their huge endowment and their huge return on investment, because when they went to liquidate some of this to actually make payroll, they realized that if you own 1 million acres of forest in Brazil, trying to liquidate part of it or any of it to generate enough money that you could pay your faculty didn't work real well. And when they were able to liquidate, they got much lower prices than they had anticipated. I mean, much lower, meaning like half or a quarter of the price that they expected at based on the estimates that they had. That's the problem of non-liquid alternate investments. And it applies to people who are investing today. If you're investing in alternate investments, even if you're investing in an ESG, a fund or something that's liquid, an ETF that's using alternate investments, it's entirely possible if there's a sell-off that you could say, I need my money. I actually need cash from this thing. And they say, I'm sorry, we can't get it to you because the underlying investments are illiquid. Same thing is true in real estate trusts and real estate limited partnerships.
Do you mind if I throw this in here? It's true in real estate, period. If you put $100,000 into a convenience store real estate down the road and you say, tomorrow I want to buy a car, let me take a withdrawal. Well, it's not money. It's a physical asset. And you don't track the value of that physical asset except on paper unless you're hiring an appraiser to come out every week to give you a price, which is relatively expensive.
There is an exception to that. The president got $21 million out of a hotel.
It wasn't a hotel. It was his mansion.
No, hotel owned by somebody else, but he was in partnership with the person.
Oh, yeah. That's the Vegas Trump Hotel. Yeah.
And he withdrew $21 million from it. There's exceptions if you're a billionaire. Now, if you're not a billionaire, you're probably going to have a lot of trouble pulling money into real estate.
In that case, it wasn't just real estate. It was also the management of the hotel. So there's cash on hand. It wasn't just real estate. If he had just owned the real estate and he had a stream of income coming in, that's what he could withdraw, is that stream of income. But you can't just say, I'm gonna withdraw the northern corner of the building. It for some reason that doesn't work very well.
Now there is a big exception to that. If you're invested in stocks, let's say you're in a mutual fund that invests in real estate, it's a real estate mutual fund. In many cases, and if it's a mutual fund, I'm quite confident you'll find that it's invested in stocks that are in the market. And so those stocks can be sold immediately. And if you're in a mutual fund or something, you can get within one day, the liquidation can occur, and within about 2 or 3 days, you can have money in your pocket. So there is an exception. If you're in a, if you're investing in a publicly traded company or a series of companies in a mutual fund or ETF that invest in real estate.
So long as there's somebody willing to buy you out.
Yeah.
In a mutual fund, an open-ended mutual fund, they might have to make sales. In an ETF, somebody else will have to buy what you're selling. So that's it. We've got another question. You want to, as we're coming on 5 minutes left this hour, we've got another hour coming up. The question is from Tom this time. What are your thoughts on the rollout of a vaccine or vaccines when it occurs? I mean, some people are going to be a bit complicated. There might be more than one vaccine, and public opinion on them will differ. So will consumers have choices? Will people say, I'd like to have vaccine D versus ABC, for it fits my understanding of what works best, or this political figure endorsed it? You were raising your finger. Do you want to...
Just reading about that, and there's a general consensus, it's in Bloomberg right now, as a matter of fact, that it's going to be rough. Right now, the capacity isn't there in the logistics chain, and some of these vaccines have to be very, very tightly refrigerated, and we don't know which vaccine is going to be approved. And as the writer who wrote the question said, this is something that is, we've never tried it before, and I'm very confident of one thing. There will be bugs and holdups, and it's one thing I read from Bloomberg yesterday suggested it may be the end of 2021 before we get widespread vaccination.
And throwing out all of that, that's important stuff. It will also depend on if the government is paying for it. So the testing, a lot of the testing is being paid for by government right now, by some level of government, mostly federal. But that doesn't mean that your testing is free. I was tested a couple of times in the last week just to make sure, because I've had the flu and wanted to make sure it wasn't COVID on top of the flu. And in the middle of that, I realized that I had to pay my $40 copay to talk, even though I wasn't actually talking, to do an online, I'm going to put air quotes around this, meet, because I didn't actually have a chat with anyone. I answered a questionnaire and got a message saying, yes, you should go get tested. I had to pay for that to go get the free test. So my copay was $40. I paid $40 for my free test twice. So if the government's doing it, they're only going to provide whatever they determine is the vaccine that they're going to provide. If it's not the government paying for it, then it's going to depend on the negotiation that your insurance company has with the health facility. And this gets right into the jungle that is our health system right now. You won't know until it's time for the vaccination, most likely. And if you decide to go with a different one, your price might alter drastically, and don't expect the person in the medical office to know what it's going to cost you in advance, because this system is not, it isn't based on consumers. It isn't based on customers and doing business. It's based on insurance companies as the customers and patients as a commodity. And that isn't me being cynical or something. This is, if we just look at it in pure economics, the patients are the commodity that the insurance company uses to negotiate with the health providers. So the answer to that is nobody knows. We can make educated guesses, but the educated guesses that we're giving right now are chaos. If basically the simplest approach will be to just go and get whatever vaccine your insurance company is going to pay for. Choice is not something that we have in our system. This is not a capitalistic enterprise, nor is it a socialist enterprise. It is a weird Frankenstein amalgamation of the worst parts of capitalism and the worst parts of socialism.
There. But we're down minutes, so we probably ought to tell them who we are and how to contact us.
Yes. If you would like to contact us off the air, we have voicemail waiting locally at
947-1111.
You can reach that same voicemail at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. We actually do give fiduciary investment advice to people of high net worth. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, and you will find contact forms there. You'll also be able to look at recordings of our radio program going back lots of years and our newsletter. You can get signed up for the newsletter. You can also email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Until next hour.